So what I wanted to do today is that I'll do a bit of the traditional stuff. I want to talk a bit about what happened on Palm Sunday, talk a bit about what we sometimes call Holy Week, the events that happened between Palm Sunday and what we call Good Friday. But as I mentioned in the prayer, one of the things that I try to do is that whenever I'm looking at any of these kind of biblical narratives, especially the ones that are so familiar to us, is I want to look past the events. Because the things that I think that, well, I say for myself, when I first started reading the Bible as an adult, whenever I looked at the people in the Bible, I always looked at them as Bible people. You know, Bible people were somehow different than real people. And as I've spent more time kind of studying the Bible and studying kind of supporting information around the Bible, the thing that I've come to realize, and this is kind of like a duh moment, but duh, they're not Bible people. What kind of people are they? They're people people. They're just like you. They're just like me. They have the same emotions that we do. Right? I mean, Peter had loads of issues. You know, we kind of hold him up as kind of a saint. He didn't act too saintly based on the documents that I read. And the point is that we all struggle. And God speaks into our lives in all kinds of different ways. And God tries to show us things in all kinds of different ways. And God invites us to be part of what he's doing in many different ways. And the way we start to understand that is by looking at what we have, the narratives in the Bible, and what was happening around these people, and how people responded to it, or in some cases didn't respond to it. So as we kind of head towards Easter, and what, you know, if you're someone who puts your faith in Jesus, Easter is kind of the biggest event in human history. It's what changed everything. But it happened over time, and today we look at the week that leads up to that. So let me just jump right into kind of the events that we tend to talk about on Palm Sunday. So this comes from a guy named Matthew. Matthew was actually with Jesus at the time that he was in his ministry. And Matthew tells us that Jesus is riding into town on a donkey, and there's huge fanfare. And Matthew goes on to say that most of the crowd spread out their garments on the road ahead of him, and others cut branches from the trees and spread them on the road. And that's where we get the Palm Sunday thing. As they talk about cutting out the branches and spreading them on the road, they're spreading out, at least some of them, were palm leaves, as well as their cloaks and their, we'll say coats, let's not say clothes, let's say their coats on the street, on the road. Why would they do that? Why would they do something like that? Well, what they're demonstrating is what they're saying is that we see you as a king, that as a king, you're above the rest of us. So we're going to lay our cloaks down, we're going to lay these branches down, so that as you ride into town, not only do your feet not touch the ground, but even the animal that you're riding on, their feet doesn't touch the ground. And so they're elevating up, they're celebrating him. And the thing is, why are they so excited? Well, as we read on, Jesus was in the center of the procession, and all the people around him were shouting, "Praise God for the Son of David. Blessings on the one who comes in the name of the Lord. Praise God in highest heaven." The entire city of Jerusalem was in an uproar as he entered. And what happens there is they're kind of looking back at some Old Testament prophecies. And they're saying that the Son of David, the person who's been promised, has come. And the thing to remember is that at the time of Jesus, Israel was not a free nation. They were actually subjugated to Rome. And in reality, they had not been a free nation for a very long time. And there's an Old Testament prophecy from the book of Zechariah that said that one day a righteous and victorious king would arrive. And the thing to remember is that by the time of Palm Sunday, a week before Jesus' crucifixion, Jesus had kind of become famous. You know, people had heard about him. Many people had seen him. And they'd heard that he was different, and he was righteous, and they were hearing stories of healings and these other things going on. So people were pretty aware of him. And the thing that made him stand out is that he was doing all of this good, and he was achieving so much. Yet he was humble. He had humility. And now here he is riding into town on a donkey, just like was promised 500 years earlier. So basically, they're like, this is the guy who's been promised. But here's the thing. They had their own perception of what this incoming king would do, this person known as the Messiah. You know, we look, you know, 2,000 years later, we look back as Jesus as kind of a faith leader. For them, they were looking for a warrior. That's why they talk about being the son of David, that yes, he is of the line of David, but they thought he was going to be a king like David. And David loved to go to war. And so what they were thinking was, when this new king arrives, he's going to lead us in the battle. And all these people who've been walking over us, and all these people who've had all the power, we're going to take it back. And we're going to get all the power. You know, one of my favorite analogies is that what they were waiting for was him to reach out, grab his robe, tear it open with a huge M, Messiah, like Superman. I'm here to save you. I'm going to change everything. And he did change everything, but not the way they expected. And the thing that makes the events of this week so kind of noteworthy is this crowd that is cheering for him on Sunday, so excited with expectation. By the end of the week, things change. By the end of the week, people have turned against him. And I think what we'll find as we go through the narrative, the reason they turned against him is because once he didn't meet their expectations, once he didn't do exactly what they expected, once he didn't meet their preconceived ideas of what God was supposed to be doing in their midst, they completely turned against him. So if we look at the events as they happen later in the week and as we reach Thursday, what we sometimes call Maundy Thursday, the evening of the Last Supper, Jesus is sitting down with all of his apostles, and he's explaining to them that a time has come now where I will depart from you. And they're kind of confused, because they're generally confused most of the time when he talks. They're not quite sure what he's saying, what he means, because even they had their own preconceived ideas of what he was going to do. And they complete the meal. Again, we call this the Last Supper. It's what we celebrate with communion. He goes out to a garden to pray. His apostles go with him. And as they expect this quiet moment that Jesus is here now, they're kneeling down to pray. What happens? Roman soldiers show up to arrest Jesus. And the expectation is, as a great warrior king, what was he going to do? Pull out the swords and fight. But he didn't fight. He went willingly. And what made it even more painful is how the soldiers found him. It was brought by a guy named Judas. Now, we know the name Judas, but who was Judas? Judas was Jesus' friend. Judas had been walking with Jesus for, we think, about 3 years. He was one of his closest followers. And Judas comes along, and instead of actually defending Jesus or being there with Jesus, he actually brings the people who arrest Jesus. Why does he do that? Because Judas had expectations. Judas was like, well, when he rises up and becomes king, he becomes the guy. I'm the guy next to the guy. So when he becomes the guy and he gets power, I get power, right? But Jesus wasn't doing those things. So Judas makes the decision that, well, if he's not going to give me what I'm owed, I better get it while I can. And so one of Jesus' friends literally goes to the religious leaders and says, how much money will you give me if I will tell you how to find him? And this is how Jesus gets arrested. Now we know that Jesus is then taken to religious leaders to be tried. They want to execute him, but the problem is the religious leaders don't have the authority to execute him. So they go to the governor, a guy named Pilate, sometimes called Pontius Pilate. And they take Jesus to Pilate and say, he's a revolutionary. He's trying to overthrow the kingdom. He should be executed. So Pilate says, well, I make the decisions about who gets executed, so let me talk to him. And Pilate talks to Jesus and realizes that Jesus has done nothing wrong. Pilate understands that the religious leaders are actually jealous of Jesus. Why are they jealous of Jesus? Well, because the religious leaders had built this system, right? That they were built on the Old Testament, which was the law, but the religious leaders had layered a bunch of, I'll call it goo, on top of the actual rules. And the religious leaders had constructed this system that said, you can't go to God by yourself, you need me to go to God. And you're dependent on me. And then Jesus comes walking around saying, well, you know, Yeah, those guys know the law, they know the stuff, but you don't need them to reach God. You can have that relationship yourself. That Jesus tells us that the things we see him do, the connection that he makes to God, is available to us. And so Jesus was threatening their power. And Pilate understood that. And so Pilate goes out to the crowd and says, I've seen nothing worthy of death for this guy. How about I just release him to you? And what does the crowd do? The crowd goes into an uproar. They start demanding that Jesus be executed. And here's the thing that's really important to note, really important to understand. That crowd that is demanding on, you know, kind of early Friday morning that Jesus be executed, many of the people in that crowd are the exact same people who were in the crowd on Sunday cheering for Jesus as king. And now they're demanding that he be killed in the worst possible way possible, hung on a cross to die, a death that takes hours at best, can sometimes take days. What's going on? How do they go from cheering for Jesus as king to demanding his execution? Comes back to expectations. That they had this idea of what God was supposed to do. And we can actually back that issue up as we look a little closer at the accounts of the execution. Because Luke, the author Luke, who's actually someone who researched the events, the author Luke tells us what happened. Luke tells us that during Jesus' time on the cross, he was not executed alone, that there were two other men there with him, men just known as criminals. Now, if you look at the Greek words that are translated as criminals, we get the sense that they were probably pretty rough criminals. We think that they might have been what's called a brigand, which is just a land pirate. So they are people who actually kind of laid in wait for travelers to get outside of town, then attack them and rob them and sometimes kill them. And so these are the two men that are hanging there being executed on crosses next to Jesus. And Luke tells us that one of the criminals hanging beside Jesus scoffed. So you're the Messiah, are you? Prove it by saving yourself. And us too, while you're at it. Hey, if you're so great, what are you doing hanging here? You're in the same situation we are. If you're so great, get out of here and take us with you. Now, coming from a violent criminal, maybe that would make sense. But Luke tells us that same idea, that same attitude, had spread much further, much wider. Because Luke also tells us that the crowd watched and the leaders scoffed. And leaders are religious leaders. Religious leaders scoffed. They said, he saved others. Let him save himself if he really is God's Messiah, if he really is the chosen one. And there we have it. Right? From the criminal to the everyday person to the righteous, or what I might say, to the self-righteous, they all saw Jesus as the same. That God's supposed to be doing things the way I think he should be doing them. And this Jesus guy's not doing them that way. So it can't be that I have it wrong. It must be that Jesus has it wrong. So he can't be these things. He can't be who he says he is. He can't be from God. Now, it would make sense that Jesus may have been a little bit confusing to them because the religious leaders had been the ones who told people what the relationship with God was like for so long. So as Jesus comes along, and because he does things a bit differently, yeah, that might have led to some confusion. But as he lived out his life, he constantly demonstrated this personal connection to God, this ability to tap into what God made available. And here's the challenge. There had been a whole bunch of religious people, religious leaders most of all, but other people as well, who had identified their relationship with God as what God was going to do for them. And then Jesus came along, and Jesus did talk about the sort of things that God does in our lives, but what else did Jesus do? Jesus talked about what God calls us to do. And if our relationship with God is about what we get, and somebody like Jesus says, well, yeah, you'll get some things, but what I'm calling you to do is do, to change lives, that if you want to see transformation in your own life, serve other people. Be there for other people. And so if your faith is built on what you get, and somebody says, go and do and give, it doesn't fit. And that was true for certainly one of Jesus' closest followers, Judas, the one who sold him out, deciding that I better get what I can while I can. But it was actually at many different levels. And if we're not careful, we could seem like everyone missed it. That if Jesus really is Jesus, if he really is who he says he is, how is it that no one prior to the crucifixion saw him for who he truly is? Well, a lot of people didn't see who he was, but some people did. And the Gospels account for us at least two people who actually see Jesus as who he is. And one of those people is a woman named Mary. And what's kind of interesting is that when you read the New Testament, as you read the Gospels, if you're someone like me who actually talks about these things to people, you know what my biggest frustration in the Bible, or the New Testament at least? How many women are named Mary? You know, could I get like a Mary, you know, I don't know, Joyce, Jane? It's tough because there's all these Marys in the Bible. There's a bunch of Johns too. But the thing to understand here is that when we talk about this Mary this morning who actually saw Jesus for who he is, we're not talking about Mary, his mother. We're not talking about the woman named Mary who traveled with him all the time. This was yet a different Mary. And she had a sister named Martha. And some of you, if you've been around church a long time, may know the story of Mary and Martha. And she also had a brother named Lazarus, who Jesus had healed at one time. And Mary does something very strange. As Jesus is actually preparing to ride into town for what we call Palm Sunday, he stops by Mary and Martha's house. And it turns out that Jesus appeared to be good friends with Mary and Martha. He often stopped by their home. And as Jesus stops by their house, Martha starts doing what Martha tends to always do. She starts getting very focused on entertaining, on making a big dinner, that we're going to kind of make a big event of this whole thing. And Jesus is there preparing for the final week of his earthly life. And so Martha is absorbed in making dinner. Not that making dinner is a bad thing, but maybe she was missing something bigger that was going on. Because Mary did something else. And what she did seems very strange. And so the author John tells us that then Mary took about a pint of pure nard, an expensive perfume. She poured it on Jesus' feet and wiped his feet with her hair. Now, Martha is making dinner. Jesus and the other apostles are kind of hanging around, getting ready, kind of waiting for dinner, it would seem. And then Mary does something that would have been incredibly awkward. Imagine if you're sitting at a dinner table and somebody starts doing this, walking up to someone's bare feet, probably dirty feet, and starts wiping perfume all over them. Would you be comfortable? You wouldn't. I wouldn't anyway. They weren't either, right? Because the way that they ate was also different than us, right? They didn't sit at a dinner table. They did what they call recline, which means that they would actually lay on their side with their feet behind them with a pillow under their arm. And they would kind of eat with one hand, kind of from a middle area. And so they're all laying facing forward, their feet behind them. And then suddenly this Mary starts rubbing perfume all over Jesus' feet. And it would have seemed awkward. And the account tells us that she's putting so much on there, the whole room smells like the perfume. And Judas, who's still there at this point, starts going, what is she doing? That stuff's worth a ton of money. She's wasting all that. Now, of course, we know that Judas wasn't really concerned about what it was worth. He was concerned about what he could have got if he could have sold it. And so Judas is kind of giving Mary a hard time about what she's doing, and then Jesus steps in. Jesus said, leave her alone. It was intended that she should save this perfume for the day of my burial. Now, he's not getting buried yet. He won't get buried for another, almost week. Like 6 days later. And it says the perfume was saved for this. So that implies that Not only does Mary understand that right now something is going on, but she knew beforehand. Somehow she knew beforehand that a day was coming when Jesus would be executed. And she at least had the sense that she should be prepared for that day. Now, the thing that's interesting to note is that this kind of wasn't a secret. Jesus would talk about this often, that a day is coming when these events will happen. Yet no one else got it. No one else understood. So how did Mary become the one to understand? Well, if you hear the story of Mary and Martha, if you've been in church for any length of time, there is a very famous story, if you're a church person, about Mary and Martha, where Jesus was visiting their house a short time earlier, right? So the events of the perfume were on Palm Sunday weekend. Sometime before that, while Jesus was traveling, he had also stopped by their home. And when he stopped by their home, what do you think Martha was doing? Martha was entertaining. Martha was making dinner. That's what Martha always did. And in the next room, Jesus was teaching. And the thing that would have looked odd in that moment is that Martha was doing what women do. They go off and they cook in that culture. And there's a room where Jesus is teaching, a room that would have been filled almost entirely with men, except for at least one woman. Who was it? Mary. The expectations were that the women go off and cook and the men go off and learn. And Mary wasn't bound by those expectations. That Jesus is here, someone special is here, and he's saying things that are important, and he's saying things that matter. And so Mary decides that, you know, as important as entertaining and eating is, this is more important right now. I'm going to be a part of it. And it may look out of place. And odds are the men in that room were probably talking about her while she was there. And Martha gets upset. Martha decides that, hey, I'm doing all the work here. Mary should be out here working with me. So Martha goes to Jesus, expecting Jesus to tell Mary that she's doing the wrong thing. Martha says to Jesus, I'm doing all the work. Mary's just sitting here doing nothing. But what does Jesus say? Martha, Martha, you're worried and upset about many things, but few things are needed, or indeed only one. You're running around worried about all this other stuff. Not saying those things aren't important, those things aren't valuable, but in this moment, there's only one thing. He goes on to say that Mary has chosen what is better, and it will not be taken away from her. Jesus' point here is that we are all, I'm going to use the word in danger, we're all in danger of just doing what we've always done. We get caught up in doing the same things we've always done. We get caught up in our expectations of what each day should look like, the grooves that we get into, the routines that we are in. And not that any of those things are bad. But if we get driven constantly by routine, and we just keep our head down and keep doing the same things we've always done, kind of the old one, right? You keep doing what you've always done, what happens? You get what you always got. That in their midst, God was doing something utterly amazing. That as Jesus was teaching that day, he was talking about the power of God, the presence of God, what could happen in our lives as we connect with God. And Martha missed it because she was doing what she'd always done. Not that what she'd always done is bad, it just wasn't right for this moment. Mary saw it, understood it, heard it. And one of the things that's so amazing about this is that odds are that in that room as Jesus is teaching, his apostles were probably in that room at the same time. Yet they missed what he was saying, where Mary had clearly understood what he was saying. Because this goes back to something that we've talked a bunch about, that not only was Mary there, she was present. She wasn't distracted. She wasn't thinking about other things. That it's very possible that the apostles are sitting there going, oh, I've heard Jesus talk about this 1,000 times. We're with him all the time. We'll hear it again tomorrow. I'm not saying they did. I'm just saying it's a possibility because I do know they missed it. But Mary didn't miss it because she took this opportunity to not just be physically there, but to be present, to be seeking God's leading. And that led her to do what others had not done. What ends up happening is that all these men who'd been traveling with Jesus for so long, when he's on the eve of this ride in on Palm Sunday, to them it's just kind of another day. They saw crowds around Jesus all the time. But Mary saw what was really happening. And here's the key thing. Where those apostles got to be witnesses of what were happening, Mary got to be part of what was happening. That she was in step with Jesus. She was actually part of the work that he was doing. Because that's how God does what he does, is he works through you, he works through me. That he doesn't want us just to be witnesses, he wants us to be participants. To be active in what he's doing. And Mary demonstrates how we get there, that we choose to be present, we choose to be part of it, we choose to listen, we choose to be connected. We choose to be willing to interrupt our routine sometimes to be part of something bigger than ourselves. And Mary becomes kind of an eternal part of this huge event of Jesus by listening, being present, and being connected. And it shows us something that I think is super valuable, that as important as it is to be present in any given moment, that our relationship with God is just like our relationship with another person. The more often we are present, the closer we get, the more connected we become. That any given moment's important, but if we're willing to be present in moment after moment, we get more connected, we get more tapped into each other. And that's what was happening with Mary. She was getting this deeper understanding because she was consistently connected when the opportunity arose. And because of that, she did something amazing. But the other thing I want to point out is that even if you are a person who struggles to feel connected to God, if a person who's never really felt connected to God, it is never too late to become connected, to reach out, to try to connect with God. Because in this narrative, remember I said that there are two people who understood what was going on. There was Mary, who had this kind of long-term relationship of knowing Jesus. But there was another person who had just met him, literally just met him. Remember that we say when Jesus is executed, he is on the cross, and there are two other people being executed with him, both criminals. Remember the first criminal we met earlier was specifically taunting Jesus, saying, hey, you know, if you're so special, get us out of here. But the second criminal had a different attitude. As the first criminal is taunting Jesus, Luke goes on to tell us, the other criminal protested. Don't you fear God, even when you've been sentenced to die? We deserve to die for our crimes, but this man hasn't done anything wrong. Then he said, Jesus, remember me when you come into your kingdom. And Jesus replied, I assure you today you will be with me in paradise. Take the dichotomy of the two other men. One had actually reached the end of his life, the first criminal, and basically said, you know what, I'm dead anyway, I'm going to do what I want to do. But the other criminal said, wait a minute. I think God's doing something different here. I see what God is doing here. Now, I may not be certain about it, but this Jesus guy is something special. He's something different. And so he basically realized that, you know what? That he may have been coming to the end of his life, but he realized that God, through Jesus, was doing something that was bigger than this life. And he was willing to ask for that, to tap into that, to embrace this gift from God that was sitting right next to him in his death. The thing I want us to see as I finish up this morning is that God is reaching into your life. God is trying to show you things. God is trying to call you towards doing things. God is calling you to be a bigger part of something. And no matter what age we are, there's a way to be a part of that. There's a way to be active in that. But if we just keep doing what we've always done, if we don't open our eyes to other things that God is doing around us, we're going to consistently miss them. We're going to consistently miss out on what's available to us, to what's possible. And if we're like so many of these people we were talking about at the beginning of the message, where our relationship as God is, I call on God when I get stuck and he gets me out of it. Sometimes he does. But when I have to pray for my way out of that my own decisions got me into, maybe I need to reevaluate how I'm doing things. Maybe God was trying to show me earlier a different path. Maybe God was trying to open my eyes to the fact that the things that I've become focused on are not where all my focus should go. That there may be things that I'm doing that are good things in themselves. They just can't be everything. We don't want to miss what God's doing. We don't want to miss what God is calling us to. Because I guarantee you that God is calling you into an active relationship with him, but also an active part of life of serving other people. That Jesus said that the way you would know my followers is their love would be overflowing from them. That's how we're called to behave. That's how we're called to live. That's how we're called to act. That's how we demonstrate our relationship with God. That's how we demonstrate our relationship with Jesus. Is allowing his power to guide us, to transform us, and lead us into action, making difference in other people's lives. But we only find it when we're present, connected, and engaged with God and with the folks around us.